Humans are notoriously amazing at self-distortion. We're not always very good at correctly evaluating and then reporting on ourselves. We don't accurately recognize our internal states, and many of us are kind of disconnected from the body's cues. As a mental health professional, I often experience the disconnect, and I ask people simple things like, "Hey, how you doing? How are you feeling? How is your sleep?" But this internal data, mood, sleep, heart rate, those are the metrics by which we assess the outcome of or the need for different mental health interventions. One such intervention is psychedelic therapy. As we begin to explore how psychedelics can change the way that mental health and other healthcare services are provided, we come back to the problem of data. How do we know that this new class of treatments is working? How do we measure our own healing? How do we know which interventions are called for? Today, we're diving into an explanation of how technology can help us answer some of these questions in the form of digital therapeutics. It's hard to define precisely, but digital therapeutics leverage software and personal data to create treatment and healing plans. So in my conversations today, I'm talking about how digital therapeutics can provide both clinicians and clients with real-time, accurate data that answer the question, "How are you?" Welcome to Mind Curious, a podcast for those looking to explore the healing potential of psychedelic compounds. In this show, we'll dive deep and test our understanding of what consciousness is, while talking to experts in the field who are no strangers to tapping into the curiosity of the mind. I'm your host, Dr. Sherry Walling. Let's dive in. I want to add one quick common sense reminder. This podcast does not constitute medical advice. The perspectives of the guests are theirs alone, and they don't represent me, my opinions, or those of MindCure Health, our sponsoring organization. My first guest is Jeff Belair. He's the Chief Technology Officer of MindCure Health. Now, this term gets thrown around a lot, but believe me when I say that Jeff is a professional disruptor. He spent over 30 years in the fintech industry as an architect, building banking systems that replaced huge mainframe computers with comparatively tiny PCs. It was a massive shift at that time and really shook up the finance world. But Jeff was drawn to the digital therapeutics and psychedelic research space because he saw another opportunity for disruption. His team at MindCure is working on a digital therapeutic platform called iStream. iStream aims to give therapists the data and the tools to really evaluate the care of their patients at every stage of an intervention, whether or not it uses psychedelics. iStream incorporates modern technologies, including wearable biometric monitoring devices, commonly just called wearables, natural language processing, and machine learning, and more. Now, if this is getting a bit too jargony, I understand. We're going to start from the beginning. The piece that you're working on within this conversation falls under the umbrella of digital therapeutics. Mm-hmm. How do you define that term? What does that mean to you?
Yeah, it's interesting because I probably research this at least once or twice a week because I'm wanting to always see what the landscape looks like. And when you look that word up or look at those two words up, you always find every week, it seems to me, a new definition of that. So it itself is a changing landscape. But to me, this category of healthcare is a set of technologies that are based on cognitive behavioral therapy. So that's the core to it. So what I mean by that is it's designed to assist clients in making a lifestyle change. So you can think of somebody that maybe is suffering from depression and they don't want to suffer from depression anymore. So there's a journey for them that can be orchestrated through a professional. And the idea is to move them along that spectrum from this current state that they're in into a better state is probably the best way to describe it. And so if whatever technology you're bringing to bear does that, then in my opinion, you have something that I would call digital therapeutics. So that's the way I describe it, because there's a lot of other things that come into play around that, lots of bells and whistles and things that people are looking and working on outside that. But that's core to me. Like, if you're not building a technology that helps move somebody from one state of mind to another, I don't know. I think it might fall into a different category then.
Then it's not therapeutic, right?
It's not just therapeutic.
Technology.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a medical record system or something of that nature. Yeah, exactly.
So the technology that you all are working on is, do you say it iStream?
It's iStream. So it's a small I and all the rest are capitals, STRYM.
Tell me about it. What are the things you're thinking about as you put it together? And I realize it's not complete yet, but you're in the planning, building, architecting process.
Yeah, we're in the planning, building, interviewing, getting feedback from all the subject matter experts out there. So the way I like to describe iStream is, it's about asking the question, how can we help? And there's three types of consumers for iStream in our minds. There's the practitioner or the professional. There's the client who may be working with that practitioner. Sometimes we refer to them as the health optimizer. And then down the road, we see being able to help researchers in their quest to find new novel molecules and provide research into the psychedelic arena and help move that forward. So when you look at iStream, yes, in my opinion, it's a digital therapeutics platform. It's a set of technologies operating as a service. In my world, we call that SaaS. So it's an acronym, SaaS, or software as a service. And it's serving as a tool for psychotherapy to clients. The idea behind it is, over time, we're going to build up one of the largest repositories of psychedelic experiences so that we can arm practitioners with an understanding of what's the best medical protocol for their clients. So this is a great insight for them that they might normally not have in that traditional sense that we were talking about earlier.
And so this allows for therapists, health professionals, medicine keepers to have this bit of data or information about how their patient is faring, both in response to medicine and in the time between sessions, maybe between a medicine session and a follow-up integration session.
Yeah, maybe I can just speak to that a little bit because I think it's kind of important. So, you know, you go through an assessment with a potential client. If that is successful and you feel that you have a particular psychedelic or medical protocol that you will think will help somebody, so somebody might have PTSD and so MDMA might be a likely candidate, then what they often have is this sort of a purge process that happens maybe a week or two before your first session. iStream can play a part of that as well because we can give the person a wearable device, and this allows us to create a baseline of what we call biometric information, and it can also be psychometric information before the actual medical protocol is applied in a set and session.
So you might go into that session knowing a lot of data about how well they've slept.
Exactly.
You might have some self-report kind of mood information,
yep.
Maybe some heart rate information. So you're walking in armed with more data than self-report can give us.
Exactly. And so during the session, we can gather a bunch of information with the consent of the client, of course. That's very important. We can record the session. And then iStream has the ability to analyze that recording and provide feedback to the clinician to give them insights that they might not have caught during the session, during their discussion with the client or not, simply because they've been focused on the client through the session to make sure that their journey is the exact journey in practicing of their art the way they wanted it to be, right? So in the background, iStream is doing all of this sort of like a helper collecting this information that the clinician can then review later and get some additional insights.
So for example, could you say something like, oh, this theme came up a lot for this person as they were talking through their experience. That theme that they were discussing was accompanied by this physiological reaction. So every time they talked about, you know, a certain kind of tree that they remembered as a child, maybe they're having a physiological reaction. So we really want to dial in and pay attention to that as a key component of their healing process.
Yeah. And that's where the art of the practitioner comes into play because they know what to look for. They are guiding through that. And iStream in the background is doing its thing, monitoring biometric information. So if that journey gets into a good space for what they're trying to achieve, but it might be a tense moment, it can record heart rate and oxygen levels and other things that are new information that the practitioner might normally not get. iStream is giving them some feedback that they can look on a tablet or whatever's convenient for them and view that additional information and just empower the practitioner to be more mindful of the state of their client.
That's one of the things that I'm really excited about as a practitioner, to begin to utilize some of these techniques and tools eventually someday, because self-report is wonderful, but is also notoriously inaccurate. So I might ask my client, hey, how was your sleep for the last couple weeks since I've seen you? And they're going to remember like last night and maybe the night before. But to see that true data sort of unfold over 2 weeks is really, really extraordinarily valuable, because I'm getting much more accurate information. And especially in the context of trauma work or PTSD work, where we really are trying to take really good care of a body that's under stress, as much as we're trying to listen to words and care for emotions, I feel like this really equips a practitioner in ways that, you know, we haven't been able to access before, maybe outside of large university settings or hospitals where we have access to biometric, you know, measuring tools.
Yeah, exactly. We often refer to it as the integration process. So post the medical protocol, there's an integration protocol. And so post leaving the office of the practitioner and going home back into their environment, whatever that might be, what happens now? So by having iStream still there for them, it helps the client go through the integration process, which they might have agreed with the practitioner. And that could be some type of meditation that they agree to do. It could be music therapy. It could be all sorts of things that are available that suits that client best. And as they do those things, they can get gentle reminders from iStream on their smartphone device. Have you done your meditation today, for instance? Or you might say, I don't really feel like meditation, so choose something else. And all this gets tracked by the digital therapeutic platform, iStream, and is recorded back and presented with, again, it's important to note that all of this stuff that gets recorded is by the client's permission. So they always have the option of opting out and opting in to this collection of data, because we want to build trust. So it's important for them to know that they might not want to share that. But if they choose, they can even journal and say, I'm not feeling great today. And the beauty of that is, as you noted, they go away and it might not be 2 or 3 weeks before they see their professional again. And during that time, if they didn't have iStream and they come back and the clinician says, so, you know, how did you feel last Tuesday at 10 o'clock?
I have no idea.
I have no idea. I don't even know if I was sleeping or not. So the beauty of that is that iStream presents this dashboard of information that, yeah, the clinician may still ask those questions when they next meet the client, but they have a wealth of information, what I like to call actionable data in front of them on the dashboard.
iStream has so many exciting clinical implications. Importantly, the data it collects and analyzes can be reviewed by clients at any time from a customized dashboard. But the AI won't make treatment suggestions based on the data directly to the patient. Instead, it only presents those suggestions to the therapist. That's because Jeff and his team are trying to ensure that the data they're collecting is being used responsibly. We'll come back to that in a little bit. First, I want to talk about another organization that is using biometric data and wearable technology to shift the paradigm in mental health care. My second guest is Eric Kerr, founder and CEO of LifeTrack. LifeTrack is an innovative organization that uses a Finnish sleep and activity tracker called the Oura Ring to predict outcome in addiction and rehabilitation. Eric has some fascinating thoughts about the nature of all of this new biometric data collection and analysis, and some deeply personal reasons for getting involved in this field. We have access to all of this data now, or at least access to the ability to collect all of this data about our own bodies and our own rhythms. But there are very few ways to interpret that or use it in meaningful ways. So the ability of making our own data accessible to us and meaningful to us as humans seems extraordinarily important, and kind of like the anti-Facebook. Like,
yeah, you know, it's really interesting because it's something that we've always done, but this is new information and new data that I don't really know what to do with it. But if we stopped and just kind of slowed down and said, what historically have we been able to do with good data? And how have we used that data to improve lives and outcomes? If you look at just diabetes as an example, I have a son who's type 1 diabetic. He's 18 now. He was diagnosed when he was 16. And now he, you know, takes his blood sugar every day. He's got a monitor thing on his arm that tells him when his blood sugar is high or low. And that's all data. And he knows how to self-regulate. Whereas, you know, 50 years ago, we didn't have that. And people were often managing from a crisis state. The change is the inquiry, right? So if we fundamentally ask, what do we have access to now in terms of data that we didn't have before? And what can we do with that data to improve outcomes? And so then it gets down to what outcomes are you trying to improve? What we were trying to find out with our study with the Oura Ring and addiction relapse is, can we specifically use the Oura Ring as a piece of technology to predict that relapse is coming?
So just to back up a tiny bit, because my mother listens to my podcast, I'm pretty sure she doesn't know what an Oura Ring is. Mom, it's a little ring that you put on your finger that tracks all of this information about your body. And I'm sure, Eric, you have a much more nuanced explanation of that, but...
Yeah. Well, it tracks sleep, and more specifically, it tracks your autonomic nervous system, which has to do with your heart rate variability, basically questioning whether you're in a fight or flight state or a rest and digest state, right? So when you're in a fight or flight state, you have to ask, like, why am I in this state? So it gives you the data to begin the inquiry.
I was going to say one of the things that I know through my work is that, you know, sometimes we as humans are actually quite slow, or it's quite difficult for us to be able to observe our own inner states and kind of assess them correctly. And so the tools that you're exploring, or the Oura Ring in particular, is an objective external way to give us data about our own situation, our own body, our own mind in a moment, and then think about what to do based on how we are. And so this project that you've been working on that I think is just fantastically exciting is looking at that kind of biometric data or physiological data as predictor of addiction relapse.
Yeah. That's a really good way of stating it, Sherry. The reason I started down this path is you and I met probably 3, maybe 4 years ago. There was a time when my dad and I and my sister, who is a 30-year registered nurse, ICU certified, surgically certified, just kind of seen everything. We were playing cards, and he was 89 at the time. And I think we were playing Rummy or War or something like that. And she started playing a game with my dad, asking him to change cards to the other hand and then doing all these weird things. And so we were just kind of playing along with it. And then, like, right out of the blue, she said, "Dad, I'm calling 911 because you're having a stroke." And so she was able to essentially predict, right, that stroke was happening and it was going to get worse. And he was likely going to die unless we intervened at the time. Whereas I had no idea what was happening. And more importantly, and to your point, he had no idea what was happening, right? And so that started me on an inquiry with experts saying, can we use, because obviously there are things that are happening with the nervous system and with the brain that are manifesting physically, right, through our physical actions. But those things started firing off way before they started manifesting, maybe several days before even he started having a stroke. The value is in its predictive quality, right? And so we want to look forward to subtle changes in your body that can't be detected by your senses alone. And so this can be good forewarning of impending problems, future protocols, nutrition plans, and stuff, so forth like that. And it doesn't always have to be such a crisis state. Like, I'm going for the big wins.
We're going for the big, hairy problems that we haven't been able to really make a lot of traction on.
Yeah, which I'm saying, like, oh, this will be easy because it's so obvious, but it's such a nightmare because you've got so many businesses that are built around the current problem that they just don't want to move, right? It was like the opioid crisis, like addiction to opioids. That's not happening.
Right. That's not a problem.
Yeah, it's not a problem. says the pharmaceutical company, says the doctors who are prescribing, who are getting, you know, paid. So we're starting with very, very tiny case studies. And we're, you know, if you look at people who are suffering from addiction in prison, like if 10% of the people who suffered from addiction in prison were treated for that addiction prior to them leaving and were supported throughout, that would save, what is it? $4.8 billion a year.
Wow. Just 10%.
Yeah, just 10%. Mm-hmm. If you move that up to 40%, it would save $12.9 billion annually.
Wow.
So if you just say, what do I as a person, and anybody listening, what do I as a person have access to? You know, you've got access to quite a bit. It doesn't have to be an Oura Ring. It can be, you know, a Fitbit. I mean, there's all kinds of wearables out there right now. What you have to ask yourself, and where probably people need some help, is what should I track and what does it mean when I see this data? And how do I correlate it to see improvements in my own functional state?
So would you talk a little bit about the study that your team did? It's a pilot study. I know it's small scale, but I think it's really interesting. The study specifically about people who were participating in what began as an inpatient treatment and then moves to an outpatient treatment for addiction. I think the center that you partnered with, is it in Arizona?
Yep. Yeah, the Sanctuary.
Yeah.
So fundamentally, addiction treatment and even the healthcare system, the correction system, they're all kind of fundamentally built the same way. Is that it's highly transactional. So in recovery in addiction, somebody would go to a detox center, right, and get them clean, right? So basically, drugs are out of your system. Now we're going to take you to a recovery center where you can learn, or just we make sure that you're not falling off the bus. Those are fundamentally two totally separate organizations. They don't share typically any kind of data. One may be a state-run facility, and then another one may be a private facility. But in most cases, you're going in, you're getting clean, and the rate of relapse is about 90%. Most of these people who suffer from addiction will go through several treatment centers because clean is not healed, right?
Clean is just chemicals out of your system.
Yeah, chemicals are out of your system, but your brain is still driving for that hit, right? And when you go home, you've got all the brain-trained responses when you see your buddy, when you smell something. And it's all based really fundamentally on our senses, where the amygdala will just drive and give you dopamine hits that will drive towards the addictive habit, right? So we know now based on science that dopamine, which is the pleasure chemical, is used by the brain to lead you to the addictive behavior, right? But it doesn't give you a dopamine hit when you do the addictive behavior. It's leading you along the way. So it takes the horse to water.
It's the hope that the addictive behavior will feel a certain way, not necessarily the addictive behavior itself.
Yeah, exactly. So what we did was we talked with the Sanctuary, which is a phenomenal treatment center, but they recognize kind of the gap in the system because we would have, let's say 30, 40 people come through their 30-day program. And then they would ask maybe a week or 2 weeks after, how are things going? They had maybe a 1% reply to that email.
Wow. So people aren't engaged enough.
Totally not engaged. So when we started distributing the Oura Rings on day one, so we worked together and we changed the model from a 30-day program to a 90-day program. So it changed the model from 30 days treatment in facility where you come in, we get you detoxed, we teach you nutrition programming, we teach you meditation, we help you reestablish community. If you've got anything else going on, then we try to address those as well. But then we're going to follow you home too. And we're going to support you 60 days because most people will relapse. When they relapse, they'll relapse in the first 60 days. So we said that's really our crisis window after they leave here. And so just having the Oura Ring where the participants could see their steps as a basic measurement and tool increased the collaboration in the community with the participants themselves. Right. So they were saying, how many did you get? I got this many. What was your sleep like last night, right? It said mine sucked. Well, mine sucked too. okay, well, we both, you know, like our sleep sucks. So we've got that in common now, right?
Yeah. We don't even have to use any emotion languages, but we're sharing something kind of significant about ourselves by sharing these numbers.
Yeah, which wasn't happening before.
Mm-hmm.
And so then as we start to look at, all right, this is why your sleep is bad, because initially they would say, well, it's telling me my sleep is bad and I already knew my sleep is bad, so this thing is terrible. Well, you have to reframe kind of the purpose of the data. And even treatment centers, I've heard my, you know, some friends talk to treatment centers, they're like, well, by the time it tells us that somebody's in relapse, it's too late. True, right? By the time 911 is called because somebody's off the ditch and they're in a rollover, the rollover has already happened. That's obvious data, right? But the question now we have to ask is, what happened an hour or two before somebody rolled over off in the ditch? Maybe they were drinking, maybe they were sleepy, maybe like whatever, right? There's a whole bunch of data that we need to find out. And historically, we know
the dominoes had to be arranged in a certain way before the rollover in the ditch.
Yeah. And so now, just from the basic data, my chief science officer, because I'll ask her, I'll say, well, what do we know? And she goes, we don't know anything until we've analyzed the data. But what we can fundamentally say about the data is level of participation has gone up. We know that half the people who leave the treatment center will go into relapse. But we're also surveying them. So they're not just wearing the ring. We're asking them very simple questions that they can answer through their cell phone on a daily basis. How would you rate your sleep? How would you rate your cravings? Right. And just super like scale of 1 to 10. So now we can take that data and correlate it to the heart rate variability and the anxiety states and the sleeping pattern. And we can start to learn, okay, well, if it wasn't very good, are you sticking to your nutrition program? Are you doing your meditation? Right. All that stuff. So we have in the first couple of weeks, we've got 100% participation. So if you take the before scenario where they didn't even get them to answer an email.
Only 1% would respond to the email. Yeah.
Right. We've got everybody for the whole 30 days that they're in there responding to 3 or 4 surveys a day. And they're doing the same thing when they leave. At least half of them are following through all the way to the end. So look at all that data we have now. Right. And look at the level of participation and engagement, because if somebody knows that, okay, they're going to ask me tomorrow how I'm doing again, like that anticipation for tomorrow will increase compliance and self-control like by a lot.
Addiction, rehabilitation, and relapse are not the only areas of focus in LifeTrack's research. They're also studying suicide prevention and prison reform with predictive data modeling. Now, if you're a mental health professional like myself, you might get concerned when you realize that digital therapeutics could almost automate the treatment process. And what about the security of this personal data? What happens if it falls into the wrong hands? It's important for the creators of these technologies to think about the implications and potential pitfalls of the digital therapeutics movement. Fortunately, the team at MindCare has considered these questions. So I think I have to ask selfishly, is this brilliant product, this disruptive product that you're building, is this going to put me out of a job?
Yeah, sorry, Sherry, it is.
There's an app for that. Like, forget, we don't need mental health professionals anymore. We have this app.
Yeah, yeah. My short answer is, sorry, yes, it is. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. No, not at all. As a matter of fact, my personal opinion is that the human-to-human interaction is so critical in this. And iStream is really just a tool in the health professional and the client's tool belt. It helps guide them along when they're not quite sure. So practitioner may be looking at this dashboard that I spoke of and getting some insights from how the protocol is working, what's the efficacy of the protocol. And the client might be doing the same with their own lifestyle choices that they're making and getting some feedback of efficacy of those lifestyle changes that they're making, right? So that's always partnered with people. It's important that the human-to-human interaction continues throughout this process. So no, you're not out of a job.
Okay, good. Phew. I better go learn to code or something.
Well, there you go. There you go.
I do often feel in the context of my work, like, I wish I could just be a little like
birdie on someone's shoulder throughout the week, like whispering little reminders in their ear in a non-creepy, helpful way. Yeah. But that sense of this continuity between in-person conversations so that there's this touch point or this sense of follow through that therapy, even its traditional sense, we meet with someone once a week on Tuesday at 3 and we do that for a period of time and it's predictable and consistent, but a lot happens between Tuesdays, right? A lot transpires in people's lives. So this sense, I think, even as a that this software tool can be a human ambassador from, you know, one therapeutic experience to another is potentially really exciting.
Yeah, that's exactly true. You've said it very well.
So what are the downfalls here? What are the things you're protecting against, whether it's security, privacy, data being misused? It sounds great, but tell me about the things that people should be informed about or cautious about.
That's a great question. And it's one that probably could be a whole podcast on its own. But, you know, I might be a bit philosophical here. In the technology side of things, technology industry, they always talk about anything can be quote unquote, you can't see me, my hands doing air quotes right now, anything can be weaponized. And so the analogy that I often use is, so I own a store, a sports store, and I sell baseball bats. And so somebody comes and buys a baseball bat and they go and use it, to, I assume, to play baseball, but they could just as easily use that to break into cars, I guess, you know, as an alternative. So I guess the important part there is it's not necessarily about the technology, but it's the people behind the technology. So at MindCure, for instance, and one of the reasons I was drawn to come to MindCure is we ask ourselves these kinds of questions every day, and we hold ourselves to an extremely high standard of how do we make sure that iStream is that positive solution that moves forward in the world, and that, you know, we look at the ethical parts of it consistently, and we have team meetings around that about, you know, what makes sense here. And I can give you some examples. For instance, I've already spoken to this a little bit, but this is the idea, what I like to call guiding principles. So for instance, the client will always own the data. That's a guiding principle. They can choose to opt out at any time. They can choose to say, I don't want you to have my data anymore. And that's their choice. We have to respect that completely. Otherwise, we won't have the trust of them to use the product, to work with the therapist using the product, and to have the outcomes that we think they can have. We will be introducing AI, artificial intelligence. And I don't know if you read a lot about what's happening in the world of AI, but there's been both positive and negative press around it. So there's a guiding principle that we have is AI will be used, but it will never present its outcomes directly to a client. It will present them along with the psychometric and biometrical data to the clinician for review before working with the client to make a decision moving forward. So it can probably provide some great insights, but it's not the one making the decision. And that is just a guiding principle within MindCure that we're going to always follow through. So that's a couple examples. Around all that, of course, we're going to make sure that we secure the environment. And again, like I said, I could probably speak at long length as to how we're going about that. It's well beyond the minimum requirements that something like HIPAA requires. And we will just ensure that that's in place, and it has to be in place.
So there's lots of like big high level thinking as well as concrete details that are going into how you're
absolutely
considering how to use this well.
Mm-hmm.
Would you use it?
Absolutely. I plan to use it.
You're like, sign me up.
I'm going to be the first one to download it as soon as it's available. Yes, correct.
And I guess I'm curious, big picture, if this disruption works. I mean, the way that we provide mental health care, maybe mental health care via psychedelics, what does the system look like on the other side?
Yeah, I think it just creates a great opportunity, especially from the psychedelic arena, because it's a small community of people, again, respecting the trailblazers before us that have produced this art form and brought it forward, and now moving it into science-backed, evidence-based solutions that governments of the world just can't deny. And it allows psychedelics and the efficacy of their protocols to come into the mainstream. So a product like iStream, I hope, advances that and brings that forward so that more people can be helped by what psychedelics can offer with their mental health, and also provide scale, because right now, a practitioner using a traditional model may only be able to serve, I'm guessing here, maybe 5 to 10 clients at a time. Well, with a product like iStream working with them side by side as their assistant, if you will, why couldn't they be serving dozens more simultaneously? Because the system is giving them the feedback and information that they need. So now we've provided scale. We can now get out into the world and reach a larger and broader audience of people who need help. And Lord knows, with COVID right now, there is a lot of people like that, right? So that is fascinating to me that we could potentially set the stage for that.
You're in such an interesting spot, given the marrying of science, technology, and traditional practice, which in some ways has traditional artistic, spiritual, religious connotations. And so I appreciate the dance that you're doing as a technologist to really honor the wisdom of the tradition and the medicine keepers, but also really want to bring these traditions into the realm of science so that they can be widely accepted and have optimal benefit for a world that is certainly in need of different solutions.
Very well said. That's exactly how I feel. Yep.
Well, I'm so grateful for your time. Thank you for chatting with me. And when will we be able to see iStream in real life?
You'll start to see and hear more about it as we move into the second quarter here. So some think about the July timeframe.
Okay. So summer.
Yeah. Yep. Summertime. Be a great time. And keep in touch. More to come. Watch our website. All that good stuff, right?
All right. Fantastic. And we'll have all that information in the show notes for people who are listening who want to follow the work that Jeff and his team are doing and to keep in touch with all things MindCure.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You're going to hear me talk about the historical tradition of psychedelics as a tool for healing over and over again. And as psychedelic psychotherapy enters the Western medical world, it will inevitably be met by technological and social disruption. I'm so glad that the people who are exploring the digital therapeutic space are guided by curiosity and a desire to be of service. Again, I want to thank both of my guests, Jeff Belair and Eric Kerr, for all of their incredible and necessary work and for taking the time to speak with me today. We'll have links to their work in the show notes. To learn more about all that MindCure Health is doing, follow along the journey on social media or by visiting mindcure.com. Thanks so much for listening.